Hi, Judy.
Hello.
It's nice to get to know you, and I wanted to just get into some of the bigger, sort of more elliptical parts of what I learned talking to you the first time. For instance, the belief systems that people have as they approach information like the kind you're putting out. And not necessarily your presentation, which people have access to on the internet anyway, but just some of the ideas that stretch out from it.
It's kind of goes along with why 9/11 could get pulled off, and so many people now question it. The same thing with voting fraud, that no one wants to believe that their vote doesn't count. And no one wants to believe that they're not safe. I think they like to believe that they're taken care of and they're safe in this country, and that's what I think terrorism is all about. Controlling people with fear. But if you grow up with a certain set of rules with your environment, you get used to them. You get conditioned to them, and you want things to stay the same. What happens if it turns out everything you've learned is a myth?
Yeah. But you were saying or suggesting that things have gotten incrementally and increasingly worse.
Correct.
And that's, do you believe that that's part of the plan?
That it gets to a point where the mass, the majority of the population just can't handle looking at reality. They've been kept from reality, that now if you introduce them to it, it's too scary.
So they prefer to live in the fiction or the matrix?
Is that what the matrix is?
The matrix is it's a sort of fictionalized world. It's an unreality. It's created. It's an illusion.
I think that's true. I wouldn't have said this a year ago, but I've learned a lot in the past year.
Well, how is it that you have stepped out of the matrix yourself?
Probably never was in it.
Because of your work or your, the kind of person you are or the kind of thinking you do?
It's more of the kind of person I am. But the kind of person I am is who chose the kind of work I do, which is observing physical phenomenon. And if you are so, habitually noticing physical phenomenon and wanting to pick up every detail to come to a solution with things that don't have any impact on our society, just why did this pencil break? Then you can't not do that with the bigger picture.
That's true. But does it take courage to do that, or curiosity, or both?
Both. I'm not sure what makes the difference. Like on 9/11, I saw something was wrong. But we are social beings, and I remember looking around the room and commenting to other faculty members. We're in the faculty lounge looking at it on a TV screen. I looked at them like, isn't this weird? Isn't this crazy? Like, isn't somebody playing a trick on us? And they looked at me like I was nuts. They were in their traumatized mode, acting just as prescribed. And I felt different. And then you talk to other people and try to get them to see what you're seeing, and they don't go there. And pretty soon, you get the idea that you better keep it to yourself. It's the social pressure issue.
And is that what you did?
For the most part. But then it continued to eat on me. And I was, I guess, kind of paranoid. Like, if I just have these perception. Am I in danger speaking out? I was afraid to even look for stuff on the internet about it. You know, like, go to the library, use their computer.
Mm-hmm.
Or in my office, late at night, make sure the door is locked. Then make sure that I clean out all my cookies and all that business on the computer. Well, first, I would only do it through dial-up to look for things. I was just paranoid that I was being watched.
And then what happened a year ago?
Well, it was a couple of years ago. It was the 2004 selection. Obviously something went bad, awful wrong, and the media would not talk about it. I remember mentioning to someone that this statistically cannot be. From the exit polls, the discrepancy between those and the actual, you know, reported vote tally, the direction of what edge of the bell curve it fell off of was statistically impossible, essentially. And when I mentioned this to people, they would say, well, obviously it wasn't vote fraud, because otherwise we'd hear about it on the TV. It would be in the TV news. And that started making me nervous. So many people depended on the TV news to tell them things.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what turned things in me. I went to the first protest of my life, protesting the certification of the Ohio vote in New Mexico and so forth. January 6th, I believe it was, 2005. And there were only like 50 people there. That's when I knew we were in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I decided it was okay to risk myself and talk about 9/11 out loud.
And had you done research already? You had arrived at a certain conclusion?
I had arrived at that conclusion on that day.
Oh.
The billiard ball example that I give, I ran through that. That was my mental model to check reality. I thought, well, could it be? Could it come down that fast? And I modeled it that way just for a mental exercise of what kind of, if I was going to guess how long it would take a building like that to fall down, just a total guess, how would you guess the timing? Because it's going to slow down when one floor falls onto another floor, which falls on another floor. It can't go down. It can't go down as fast as if you threw a bowling ball over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's falling through thin air.
Right. There's resistance.
And if you're falling through the building and having it, you know, crush each floor on the way down, you're going to take a lot longer. So I came up with this mental model, and then I thought, no, it can't be. I must have the coefficient of gravity wrong. So I went through my books on the shelf. No, that's the same number I was using. Yeah. Well, maybe that book's wrong. And I checked another book. You know, it never hurts to double check what you think is true. And then I asked a colleague. I didn't tell them what I was calculating. I showed them what I was, you know, how I formulated this. They looked at me like I was nuts. Like, of course, that's, you know, I was right. This is so simple. But I couldn't go there with that person about 9/11. I felt like I couldn't express this to anyone. It was a subject you do not talk about. No one said that, but that's what our culture does about certain topics.
Yep, somebody told me today, it's a sensitive issue. I said, it's not a sensitive issue. This is something we should talk about. What is sensitive about it?
Or some would say, I don't talk politics.
Right. But I think that whole mushrooming of political correctness was to create this kind of censorship, to make this a sensitive issue, you know? And to make anything, the voting, that's sensitive. How can you suggest that it's not the way it seems?
Right. And why don't people care?
Well, that's the trick. How do you get them to care? I know a company in New York, the Disinformation Company. It's a distributor of DVDs and books, and the slogan for this company on their t-shirt is one sentence: everything you know is wrong.
I like that.
It's great. Everything you know is wrong. So that's where we have to go with this 9/11 thing. Even within 9/11, possibly, the things that we've come to believe, even we, the skeptics, those things could be wrong.
We're not skeptical enough. I'm thinking of the one healthy thing I did on 9/11. Remember, I started pulling my various physics books down off the shelf and checking the coefficient of gravity. I didn't assume I knew it. Because what you know may not be right.
Right. But, I mean, it wouldn't have changed while you were not thinking about it. It's one of those things that you memorize, like the boiling point of water.
Right, but maybe something had altered in my memory.
That's true.
And that's what I mean. Maybe what we think we know, we don't know. So it's good to, you know, some people would say, well, don't you know that number? And they wouldn't want to go check it because that would be an admission of defect. I don't know what. Some people say they'd be too proud to. But I think it's good to have checkbacks. I call it a sanity check.
Mm-hmm.
Just to make sure that you're not confused about something.
No, you say you're an observer of data and you do not jump to conclusions, or you're not even at a conclusion stage now about anything.
Correct. It would spoil the fun. The fun is along the way. It's this wonderful mystery that's unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
But, well, it's a horror story, but we have to take the best with the worst. It's a good way of, maybe it's my way of digesting it. It's just looking at the physical properties, not the human loss or the horror of it all, but looking at it as a science project.
Well, it was a physical event. That's what it really was.
And to see how they pull that off. As though we've gone to a magic show by David Copperfield.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled this rabbit out of a hat. The hat wasn't big enough to hold a rabbit, so how did he pull the rabbit out of the hat? Wouldn't it be interesting to just sit there until you could figure it out? And I think that's what we're looking at with 9/11.
So it was the whole thing was an illusion.
It was a trickery. Is that what an illusion is?
I don't know. I mean,
I think you saw something other than what really happened.
Right. I remember once setting up a display. It was the Santa House at a local mall. And my friend was a display artist, and she needed help that night. And I agreed to help her, and I had to go and staple velvet drapes behind Santa's throne, and everything was decorated like a castle. And I was upset because my velvet drape that she gave me to staple was not hanging down the same length as the one on the other side that I had just stapled, although both were now concealed behind Santa's chair, so you didn't see the hems at all. And I was complaining about this length discrepancy, and she said to me, "This is an illusion. The drapes don't need to be the same length. This whole hut that we're doing is just an illusion. That's what you're trying to create here." And that hit me, and I have never forgotten it.
Hmm.
So what is apparent is the illusion. How it happened is the reality. And there's a difference. Often in our lives.
That's an excellent way of putting it. Lately I've been so shocked by is, you know, I started looking at the pictures and putting them up on my webpage, as you know, and they start coming together as a pattern, and it becomes very apparent. I now have the entire site memorized. I know what each square inch almost looks like, where I'm standing and what's where. But what's striking is this no building, nothing left, basically nothing left. why has that not been noticed? You know, you have two over a quarter mile tall towers, 500,000 tons each. Poof, go away. And nobody realizes that, you know, there wasn't anything there after the towers went away. I'm talking about the afternoon of 9/11. You don't have any buildings.
Right.
So you don't have the material either.
Well, you had the emotional devastation. That was almost palpable, and that's what people were feeding on and experiencing, and they didn't notice the reality for a long time afterwards, except maybe in photographs as you did.
But then they've been trained to look at the photographs and feel trauma.
That's right.
And not see it. It's just so obvious when you look at the photos.
I want to ask you another question. This is something that occurred to me, and I have mentioned it in interviews that I have done. If those buildings were imploded in the classic way of controlled demolition, being a quarter mile tall and so skinny, like pencils almost.
There's no way you're going to control them.
You can't. But they would be sucked into themselves. Let's just say in the ideal situation you could do this. People would have witnessed these tall, skinny pencils being sucked into themselves.
And I don't think that's how it would be. I think it really would be like a tree. Get a tall tree.
Yeah.
And that's how they struck me. If you look at any of the videos of, you know, whatever it is, the volcano at the top of this rapidly shortening volcano, dust fountain, it looks like a tree turning into sawdust.
Well, that's how they did it. But if it were an implosion only, then it would look like Building 7 looked. It would be sucked into itself. Do you see what I'm saying? It would be very strange.
Building 7, I'm not totally convinced it was a classic demolition thoroughly. I think the majority of it was.
But well, what's odd about it to you?
It's more perfect than any controlled demolition I've ever seen. It looks like you could essentially drive a four-wheel drive vehicle around the perimeter of it on those little alleys. It was so neat and tidy.
So that too is odd.
Yes.
Well,
every controlled demolition I've seen has something spilling over somewhere, but there was no spillage into the alley.
Hmm. There were also not enough squibs, because in most of those controlled demolitions, I've seen lots of videos now, there's always the concrete puffs. They're coming out of the top, out of the sides, and you see very few coming out of Building 7.
You hear pop, 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 bang, 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 and then the building starts to do something. But that didn't happen with 7. We saw the puffs. We didn't hear anything. But I wasn't there, so I don't know if they muted that on the cameras.
Right. I'm surprised that they got video of it at all.
Oh, no, no. They wanted that video. I believe that's why they waited until 5:20. They had to wait for the dust to clear so they could get a nice clear shot of it.
So they wanted that because it would suggest to people that the other two buildings were done in the same way?
That's a good possibility. Is it the power of suggestion? Once you see that Building 7 went down like that, it was obviously controlled demolition, and it had an audience. I tape recorded. Remember how I collect data, right?
Mm-hmm.
I came home early that day, and I happened to have recorded from a rabbit ear reception TV of 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. that day, because I was going to record a regular TV show, and instead I got 9/11 stuff. But then that afternoon I came home and started recording different TV stations, just a sample from different ones to see what they were showing. And you'd have this little ticker run across the bottom of the screen saying Building 7 was in trouble, it was going to collapse. And then the ticker would go away. And then you'd see it again, and then it'd go away. You know, off and on for a couple hours, and I'm wondering, did they have loose wiring? You know, they fix the wire there so they could, you know, push the red button. And later, after it went down, some of the reporters, one particular one said, oh, they hand us all desk masks because in preparation. But then when they finally did bring it down, they took us a couple blocks away for safety.
Hmm.
So the reporters knew enough they got taken a couple blocks away for safety.
Yeah, and some of the workers knew that day, and policemen seemed to know, and BBC seemed to know. CNN knew.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a model. This was a stunt that was meant to be suggestive. You don't think any plane was supposed to hit it, or it was supposed to be detonated earlier, demolished?
Mm-mm. If it went while one and two were going poof, you wouldn't have noticed it. So why do it? It was done to be noticed. You have every network has a nice film clip of it.
But they didn't drill that into the public's mind.
Hey, that would be too obvious.
Mm-hmm.
That would be too obvious. It's I call it an Easter egg hunt. You know, for like a three-year-old. You let the three-year-old think that they're finding something.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hand it to them.
Oh, I see.
You got to let them think that they're finding it. And then just to make sure that they find the right thing, you give them a few stronger hints. Maybe you hit it for a seven-year-old, and the three-year-old needs some hints.
Mm-hmm.
And then the three-year-old really thinks they found something.
So where are the three-year-olds?
In the general public, this is just a thought I have that it's laid out too carefully. And it's focused on so much. It sort of makes you wonder why NIST hasn't issued their final report on it yet. Why it's the last one to issue a report on.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like it's the one that's there to clean up all of the loose ends, maybe?
Well, when did you join the Scholars?
Oh, in January, a year ago.
Mm-hmm. And that was with the billiard ball paper?
I had done that almost a year earlier. Well, earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I'd had that out there. I also had posted it on a forum. I think I posted it on the forum in June or July,
mm-hmm.
2005.
So it's been out a while. Tell me if you can define truth in a scientific way, if there's a scientific definition for truth. Because truth to me is a very high abstraction.
I think we're always in pursuit of it. If everything's open and shut, and you never revisit it, how do you know that you're there?
So you're saying truth has to add up across the board. Truth has to match with new discoveries.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And if your old understanding doesn't agree with new understandings, you have to resolve that. And I think it's up to every individual to resolve that. We all need to think for ourselves.
So in looking at data, you're thinking for yourself. And when you put out ideas, there are a lot of people who think that you're putting out truth, but you're not there yet.
I'm putting out the data I'm putting out is as much of a truth as you can get, I would think. It's the hard evidence. And it's uninterpreted. You can interpret it how you wish. You see a photograph of ground zero with everything at ground level, no building. How would you interpret that?
Well, I would say it's Humpty Dumpty. It all fell down. But where did it go? You'd have to ask that question.
Right. And it's figuring out that this is part of the data that needs explaining. We have this data, this building is gone. The building that was there that morning is now gone. This particular picture I have standing, it's on my homepage. You're standing on West Street looking north at the Verizon building and at Building 7, so you know what day it is. It's the afternoon of 9/11 because Building 7 is still over there. But you have this straight shot looking at it. No building in the way. It's down to ground level. You see Building 6, which is an 8-story building, there. But that's towers over the remnants of Building 1. Mm-hmm. And if you look over the entire complex, earlier that day you had 2 quarter-mile-tall buildings. Now you don't have much debris even. So that's something that has to be resolved. And it has to, whatever you come up with, it needs to match that. And I call that data, it's my current truth. Truth that you know, you're always pursuing, more. And if you find that that wasn't the total story, it's updated. But this data is as true as I can imagine it could be. I believe the towers aren't there anymore.
Right, the towers weren't there. But let me ask you about, there were large lengths of steel that were carted off on those trucks because we see them in photographs also. So there was some.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And there had to be some because it was just powder, 100% powder. I think folks would notice that.
So it wasn't as though the method got everything, forgot to get everything.
It didn't forget to get everything. They meant to leave some.
Mm-hmm.
Enough to satisfy folks.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So explain to me about...
That's a hypothesis, but that's what it would appear would make sense.
Well, this was very, very engineered. That's clear.
Mm-hmm.
And they had all the time in the world to do the prep work and the thought and the engineering.
And plan the cover-up.
Right.
The cover-up had to be planned with it.
And the cover-up is a nice mix of a little bit of
Easter eggs.
Okay. And a lot of mystery.
Yes.
So that we keep scratching our heads.
And the Easter eggs may be correct or they may be a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
They may be designed to steer us in a particular direction that may not be the correct direction. Or they may be true evidence.
Now, why would it matter if we go in an incorrect direction? If we come to the agreement or collective view that this was an inside job, just to use a very loose term, then why would it matter how? Why is it so an issue of such huge, great debate and vitriol?
I'm in my mind right now, I have this image of an 8-year-old's soccer game. Wherever the ball goes, that's where all the kids are.
Mm-hmm.
They go wherever the ball goes. You don't have a whole lot of strategy with somebody hanging over here and somebody over there, and just in case something goes through. It's 100% of the team is on top of the ball. If you have that with 9/11, and if you're one of the perps and you're steering the ball, and you have everybody on top of the ball, you have it made.
Mm-hmm.
You steer them right where you want, out of your way, and run them into the ditch.
But so the perps don't care that we know it's an inside job,
right? Because if you can't prove it, because you're off on the wrong rabbit trail. Because people do know it's an inside job. But if you pacify them with the wrong information, they won't be able to prove it.
I see. And when you say people do know, well, not everybody knows. There's an awful lot of American people who don't know, who've never even thought of it.
Oh, they probably know, but they don't want to know that they know.
So consciously they may not know, but subconsciously they've lived long enough to know that
right.
This is the case.
And they're suppressing it as hard as they can.
Well, what does that say about this country?
It means that whoever wants to control folks has an easy go at it.
Because people are allowing themselves or willing to be controlled or too frightened of the alternative?
They've been trained and don't realize they have choices.
And what are their choices?
To stand up for what's right, whatever it costs. There's a particular quote I have on my webpage that I think says it well. Martin Luther King, a time comes when silence is betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
I put that on my class webpage when I started posting 9/11 material, explaining why I was bringing it up. To not say anything about it is betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Betrayal to humanity.
Now, if you didn't have this training, would you have been able to see this?
If it's a different set of circumstances, different set of answers. Who knows what things would be like? I have the feeling that whatever I'm doing, I've always been kind of go to a different drummer, march to a different drummer,
mm-hmm.
do my own thing. I've always been fairly independent, and try not to be afraid to ask questions.
So, as a teacher, and Jim Setzer says you're a very good teacher.
Well, thanks.
You are able to create very simple analogies for people, like the wad of bubble gum. If the wad of bubble gum was used to bring down the towers,
supplemented by something else.
Right. It would have to be supplemented by something else. And then the glue and scotch tape example.
Well, yeah, if you only know how to put things together with glue and scotch tape, and somebody talks about nails can't do it. You only think about what you know about.
Mm-hmm.
And in my Seattle talk, I was presenting about what I consider as the scientific method. You don't start out with, let's see, we know about slingshots, BB guns, firecrackers, thermite, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, moe. But no, that's not the scientific method. First, you figure out what happened. Regardless of how you think it could have been done, ignore all of that. Just look at what happened. Define what happened.
Well, you said first you figure out what happened. You can't, because that's the whole point of your work here. You define what happened. You state what happened.
Yes.
You describe what was apparent.
Yeah. You first start with the data and what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still in that state. Of determining what happened, but it's becoming more clear. Questions are being answered as I look at more data. For example, the building couldn't have fallen down from natural causes. It couldn't have come down from gravity. It couldn't have come down with conventional controlled demolition because it did not fall down.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've come to the conclusion of. Why, you know, what happened to it that it didn't fall down? We haven't gotten there yet. But one thing we do know is that from the data, it didn't fall down, go boom. So what happened to it? Then you start looking for more evidence. Well, let's look at where the material went. We have this problem of conservation of mass with the official story, because where'd it go? Well, you start seeing dust all over the place and start adding that up. Is that enough material to cover what's missing? I believe it is. But you have to estimate how much dust, because a lot of it blew away.
Tell me about the dust, the 0.06 micron size dust particle.
Yeah, they apparently some folks have had problems with their lungs, and there's been various chest x-rays and other kinds of evaluations of what is in their lungs. Some samples that they've looked at with high magnification optical microscopes, I think even scanning electron microscopy on some pieces have been removed from lungs. And they found incredibly fine particulate, if you call it particulate, down to 0.06 microns. It's my understanding that red blood cells are 7 microns. So this is, you know, a hundredth of that.
Mm-hmm.
A hundredth, 1/100th of the size of a red blood cell.
And would that explain why there was all that dust that just was, you know, swirling and scudding everywhere?
There's some interesting pictures I've seen where it looks like the dust is kind of settled, and you see somebody walking down the street, and you see this very fine haze around their feet.
Hmm.
The dust has been kicked up, which is a really strange sight. Now, let's think of what normal dust is like. Think of a dirt road. You ever driven down a dirt road following another vehicle?
Mm-hmm.
You see this plume of dust behind it, but it settles out pretty quickly that if you're following them a mile behind, you have no problem seeing. It's already settled out by then.
Mm-hmm.
It dissipates, settles out. And also, if you look at conventional controlled demolition, the plume of dust doesn't really go above the height of the building.
Mm-hmm.
It goes down.
In this case, there was a chimney.
It went up.
Mm-hmm.
And out and all over. It had a very different quality about it.
But you did say the buildings were a quarter mile high, so even if the plume part didn't go up above the building, if this building were taken down in a controlled demolition, we would have had dust up there at a quarter mile, which then came down, right?
Oh, we'd have dust in the ground. Dust happens when something slams onto something else. And if you were going to bring this down with controlled demolition, you're not going to have one floor slamming onto another floor.
Mm-hmm.
It probably isn't going to break up until it hits the ground. And that was my problem with the pancaking story and the dust. You can have one or the other. If one floor falls onto another one and hits it hard enough that it pulverizes the top floor, you're not going to have it continuing down. You're not going to have, I've got this picture on my website from Pakistan earthquake where this apartment building pancake down. You don't have any dust in the air. Clear blue sky right after it happened. You know, and all the people are running around looking for survivors. You have clear sky.
And how did that building fail?
It pancaked.
But what caused it to
earthquake.
Fail? Okay.
Earthquake, it's the equivalent of getting a dynamite and shooting out all the supports all the way down. But parking garages would do that. But you don't have them turn to total powder.
Mm-hmm.
If something's going to fall apart from some progressive failure, you might end up with a pile of stuff. But it's not going to, on its own, completely pulverize. Actually, you know, controlled demolition and dynamite doesn't pulverize like that either. It just puts all the stuff on the ground so you can saw it up and cart it away easily.
So the point of pulverizing the building was to make for less damage to surrounding areas, easier cleanup, a smaller pile.
Imagine you're holding a broomstick in your hand with the brush of the broom sticking straight up,
mm-hmm.
with your palm open, and you're trying to balance that.
Oh, I see.
I think it's going to be really hard to control. It's going to go every which way. If you're going to, by conventional demolition, take out the supports of the building to drop it, that's what you have, is this beam pole balanced on nothing. It won't have its support. So,
and that was because of the design of the buildings. They were tall and skinny, right?
Correct, but they're embedded in the foundation. So they can handle the bending and the swaying and the breeze. But if you're going to drop a building by taking out the foundation mm-hmm. to use a gravity collapse, it doesn't have that lateral support anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to fall over. You have to demolish it bit by bit from the top down. But if you use controlled demolition for like the top 10 stories mm-hmm. and pretend the rest of the building is just a rigid foundation, that stuff is going to fall. And it's going to spill onto adjacent buildings. You're going to have, I call them stab wounds. The outer sections of columns, I call them wheat checks because they kind of look like that.
Mm-hmm.
If those flew off of the 110th floor, just drifted over across the street, they're going to stab right through those buildings. You're going to have an awful lot of damage.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see from Ground Zero is the damage is basically just the WTC complex.
Mm-hmm.
WTC 2 across the street from WTC 3 and a diagonal from Building 1, I don't believe it had any stab wounds in the facade at the front, yet it lost every single window.
Now, the stab wounds were from pieces of the towers.
Yeah, Building 3, WFC, the World Financial Center 3, has one little stab wound in the corner. And it had some, there's the outer wall, the western outer wall of Tower 1, looks like it hopped out in the middle of the street, kind of did this pirouette, almost made it before it was going to lay down, and it nicked the corner. And it's got some pieces that went through the corner.
Mm-hmm.
I call those stab wounds. And the Verizon building had a few, just like one little section of three wheat checks stabbed into it. But there's not too many other ones. Bankers Trust had a different type of injury in the front. It was something removed the material and just demolished the material there. Mysteriously disappeared.
Now, where did you get all these photographs? You must have looked at more photographs than anyone.
Right. I get going at them and keep trolling for them, and I stockpile them. try to note where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
Various sources. But I get the mood of what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the left side of this building or the front of this building. I want to see around that corner. And I just start looking for pictures. And then I might trip over some other ones along the way. It's as though I am physically there visiting the site. I start clicking the dog pictures. There's another theme I got into. I have various themes. That these rescue dogs running all around the site looking for somebody or something. They go down into little cubby holes and around. And we hear about the molten metal. You know, I realize none of these dogs had singed fur. They haven't had the pads on their feet damaged.
But dogs know enough not to, if there's heat emanating from a spot in the rubble, it's going to be peripherally cooler. So if a dog is approaching a hot area and its pads on its feet are feeling burned or getting burned, it's not going to go to where it's actually going to get its feet burned.
Right.
So, but you don't have reports of dogs refusing to go in certain areas either, right?
Correct.
They're going
pictures of a dog going down in some cubby hole somewhere, and then somebody lifting him back out when he was done looking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the humans have no way of getting down at those little nooks and crannies.
But didn't firefighters report molten metal running like lava?
There's a lot of verbal reports, and those are subject to interpretation. Of all the photographs I've been through, you know, thousands and thousands, I haven't seen one single photo of molten metal. Why is that?
But the molten metal would be deep. That rubble pile was unwieldy. And even though you say it was mostly powder, there were steel remnants in it. And it was, I've heard, very, very tricky to move on. Any a misstep, and you could go tumbling down into some chute yourself. So wouldn't the molten metal be deep under that?
Well, there's pictures from underground. Let's go down underground and look around. There's some past train cars that they, after they were able to unbuild the structure above them and get to them, they removed three past train cars, maybe it was four, that looked in pristine condition. But there's this one picture standing on the platform of the station right, you know, the day after or so, 9/11, where they're looking for people to rescue. They're standing in a puddle of water by the PATH train. PATH train is not crushed, the area is not crushed, and the water isn't steaming. And if it was hot down there, I mean, how hot of an oven would you hold your hand in? And when you reach in to get the bread out of the oven,
mm-hmm.
even with hot lips on, you wouldn't hold your hand there for very long. So people aren't going to be down underground if it's hot in there. There's also a photograph in the basement of Tower 2 that's just completely void. It's a complete empty space. Where'd the material go?
Mm-hmm.
They're climbing down a stepladder into this complete void.
So the stories of molten metal then are not correct?
I wonder if I think of it as an urban legend. I haven't seen any evidence of it. I'm not saying it's completely false, but I've not seen any evidence of whatsoever. And it's amazing for all of the stories we've heard that somebody might have taken their camera out and taken a picture of it. It statistically seems implausible, but there's another explanation. People interpret things the best they can with the information they have.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have something strange going on, like the material just disintegrating, people don't know how to identify that. If it was molten metal, they're not going to be walking on it with their boots. But we hear stories of all the boots that were destroyed from walking on the molten metal. That doesn't make sense, because obviously work boots aren't made for walking on lava pits.
Well, I know the quote. It comes from CBS, and it's a woman who is a relief worker, and she says, out on the rubble, it's 1,100 degrees. The guy's boots, steel-toed boots, they just melt within a few hours. So the implication there is that the rubble is hot, and the heat is coming from underneath the rubble.
Oh, but you heard that from CBS.
Well, it's filmed. I mean, it's two rescue workers talking to another guy. It's in the movie 9/11 Mysteries.
Okay. So it isn't CBS saying it. It's these people, other people
right.
saying it, who we don't know if they're real rescue workers or not.
Well,
I guess I'm skeptical with everything.
Right. No, they're apparent witnesses. But there we are again with the apparent. I mean, we don't know who they are.
But let's assume that they are real witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And what, you know, their best interpretation is that these steel-toed boots are melting.
Mm-hmm.
If your feet were in boots that were, because the steel was melting, wouldn't your feet have been burned off by then?
Well, your feet would be awfully hot, and you would say, I can't do this. You're right. If your boots were melting, then your feet would be close to melting also.
Not close to melting. I think your feet would already be cooked. It doesn't take much temperature to cook the feet.
Hmm.
It shows that before the boots reach 1,100 degrees, you've already burned your feet off. They've been incinerated. But there's something that's causing these people to say that.
But would the boots not be... I mean, the steel-toed boots are for also hiking. They make very fortified boots, which are insulated, so they keep your feet warm.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't they keep the heat out and away from your feet?
For a distance, but heat will dissipate in.
Okay.
It conducts in.
Mm.
If you have, you're cooking bread in the oven, about 350 degrees, 375,
mm-hmm.
with the door shut in the oven. Ovens are designed to insulate.
Mm-hmm.
That oven's still hot on the outside of it. Imagine if it were 1,100 degrees in there. 1,100 degrees is like a kiln.
Mm-hmm.
And boots aren't made to insulate against that type of heat.
That's true.
So in 1,100 degrees, you should have glowing metal. You know, you would know if the outer skin of the boot would have been burned off at that point.
Right, and the steel in the boots would be red hot.
Right.
Now,
But there's a reason why these people are saying this, so let's figure out what they could be describing. If we saw these beams flying through the air, trailing dust, and they didn't ever really hit the ground, it appears that they turned to dust before they hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's going on, maybe there's some process, we're just entertaining this idea, maybe there's some process that caused the steel to disintegrate. You set something in motion and, like, inoculate the steel with something that caused it to go into self-destruct.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen to boots that are walking on steel that's self-destructing? It's probably going to cause that boot to start self-destructing where it's come in contact with that. So that would probably be, yeah, you have an hour or two before the boot would be useless.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably felt something weird, like... So maybe it was burning. Have you ever poured plain Clorox on your hand?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of burns?
Mm-hmm.
It eats off the top layer of your skin. The sensation is burning. But did that mean that Clorox that you spilled on your hand was hot?
No.
So maybe they're interpreting their sensation the best way they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody tells them that they've seen molten metal, and then pretty soon they decide that must be why their boots have deteriorated.
Well, it's like the core in the North Tower, that 700-foot section of, if it is the core of tower that we see silhouetted against the blue sky, and then it vaporizes or disintegrates. So it's almost as though it's skipping logical phases. It's not liquefying. It's going to some other stage.
It's just disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's not think about what from what we know is possible. Let's just look at the data. The data is it's turning to dust.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody were walking on that material at that moment, I'm guessing that their boots would suffer.
Because whatever energy was causing this core, which is very big, thick pieces of steel, to disintegrate, that same energy would have an effect on your boots or you.
Well, I think it acts differently on different materials.
Mm-hmm.
Like steel is definitely a target more than aluminum. Because we saw a lot of aluminum cladding being thrown off to the sides, clearly, and it's not trailing any dust. But the steel part of the wheat checks is trailing dust.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting in these pictures to notice that. And you also notice from the aerial shot all the neighboring buildings. they have on the roofs, a few pieces of aluminum cladding. Never any steel wheat checks.
That is true. I always wondered where the steel was. Everything in the pictures seemed to be aluminum, and occasionally you'd see what looked like a much bigger piece. And maybe the steel was coming from inside also, because it was in the core. So maybe we didn't see it because of all the it looks like smoke, but it's dust. But the steel was definitely down at the bottom.
Oh, there's some steel down there, yeah.
Or in the rubble pile. But what about, they have recovered stuffed animals, briefcases, all these things that were in the buildings that...
Wait, all these things? I think there's like a handful of things. I think there's a calculator.
Mm-hmm.
I have a building with how many, square miles of floor space, and you have a calculator. How many computers were in there?
A lot. But I have seen the handing over of mementos that were found. There were some bodies found.
Mm-hmm.
Wallets on those bodies. And I mean, I know this from rescue workers who recovered bodies with jewelry on them, wallets in the pockets. So some bodies were left intact.
And there's different events happen at different times, and I don't usually like to think of the bodies part of it. That gets hard to deal with. But when they first started taking the building apart from the top, or when they made the holes appeared where the plane supposedly went in, when those holes appeared, you see, things shooting out, and a big fireball shooting out. If there were people in the building at that location at that time, they may have been thrown out too. Blown into pieces, and they landed somewhere.
At the fireball stage of it?
Yeah. At that point, there had to be some bodies that were blown out in parts.
But when they're carrying bodies out of the rubble, they have...
Okay, that's a different set of bodies. But
mm-hmm.
I'm saying there's reason for one type of thing. But the other, if you don't have much left of the building, you don't have desks and calculators and computers and books and et cetera, but you have a few bodies. I'm still wondering, it must not directly affect people.
Mm-hmm.
And the people were just secondary to, like boots. Boots being in contact with steel is self-destructing. It's going to destroy the boots. And maybe the person on the 80th floor or 70th floor, while the building was coming apart, they would be totally pulverized. But if they're standing by themselves next to the building, they may not be.
So this was a selective agent, because you mentioned in your talk in Seattle that car engine blocks were decimated, but paint was not.
Yeah, it seems to be selective. Like engine blocks, it likes, and door handles.
Mm-hmm.
You see a parking lot with various cars with their engines just totally gone. Engines catch fire. The gas tank does not. It's interesting.
And the main component of a car engine is steel?
There's some aluminum ones, and maybe those are the ones that didn't catch fire.
Mm-hmm.
But the fire truck pictures, I think you've seen on my website, mm-hmm. where it just looks like a monster bit out the whole engine and it's gone. There's also some hazmat truck and an ambulance with just no engine there.
Mm.
A peculiar thing. And notice also in front of the Pentagon there's a car there with the engine on fire. Same kind of phenomenon.
Well, so the 9/11 skeptics, how many times have you delivered this information? Is it just on your website, or have you given several talks?
I haven't given that many talks. On the dust, or dust, the latest document, the first time I talked about that was in Seattle, and I was actually scheduled to do the billiard ball example, but talking with them just before I went out there, and they learned of this new webpage I was just putting up a week earlier. I just started putting it up. They begged me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I went ahead and did it, because they didn't need convincing about the timing issue.
Right. The free fall is already, to the skeptics, that's already a done deal. So this seems to be new food for thought.
Right. And if we're busy pursuing the truth, let's look at it.
Now, do you know anything about these advanced technologies?
Well, after I got to page 5, the toasted cars, and that police car that's the first one on that page, that's the one that did it for me. I was thinking about what could explain this car looking like that over an FDR drive. There's a bunch of cars on FDR drive. There's also cars between the World Trade Center and FDR drive.
Mm-hmm.
That just sort of like randomly here and there, and why some places and not others. It can't be something that's localized in the building. You know, like dynamite in the building, or thermite, or whatever that's in the building.
Mm-hmm.
How can it get over and do whatever it's doing on FDR Drive? It has to be a different mechanism.
Meaning it has to be, the delivery has to be not from within.
Or if it's from within, it ends up being external afterwards. But that combined with the holes, if you've seen the aerial photographs of the holes in Building 6,
mm-hmm.
It's not one hole. It's a cluster of a lot of smaller diameter holes, very straight, very vertical, that had to come from above.
Mm-hmm.
And I have these various fascinations, like the toasted cars. The other one, or another one, is the holes in the street.
Like the soil core sample.
Right. It's a cylindrical cutout right down into the street, like six stories worth deep. Nothing there. Empty hole. There used to be soil down in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, still. Let me ask you, you're not required to know the answer to this, but just, would this be a byproduct of this plan, or is this part of the engineering? Is this more Easter eggs?
Like, was this an accident, or was it a plant, or did it have a purpose?
Right.
I'm not sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
I have the feeling, because this was such a big job, they hadn't done anything this big before on a building, that there was, this is just my sense, that there had to be a learning curve. That maybe they'd run simulations, and they have various subroutines and choices. That, well, if it goes this way, then maybe do this. And they tried those out and tested them on the first job, on Building 2, because they had more leeway there, more space to work in. And then Tower 1, they did a much better job. Like, maybe they knew which subroutine to run for particular staging.
So we're not talking about a time difference of weeks or months between the two buildings. We're talking about really minutes.
And I'm just guessing that they have a feedback loop where, okay, they sample their data afterwards. If it goes this way, then this way, this way, then we're going to use program B1
right.
for Tower 1.
So they have different plans.
Yeah,
they
depending on and just how something went, because a lot of different things can go differently, I would think, depending on the humidity that day or temperature or, you know, there's a lot of different things. Also, the towers were built in a very similar way, but still they're going to be slightly different. But Tower 2 had more mistakes. Like that big gaping hole that goes down, you know, all the way down to the bedrock. Mm-hmm. That they climbed down to the basement of Tower 2 through stepladder. Just empty hole. Amazing. And then this holes in Liberty Street.
Now, did you ever go to Ground Zero afterwards?
Not in the daytime where I could see it. And I would think that would be an interesting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I do plan on going there.
Do you think even now, after all this time, well, you could get a 3D experience of your photograph.
Right. I would know what street corner was which.
Mm-hmm. So that would be, it might be fascinating to do that and reconstruct, sort of juxtapose your photographic exploration against whatever you can do in 3D now.
Mm-hmm.
But even to try to construct a photographic exploration in the form of a DVD or something, leading your viewer through the same discovery path you went on.
Mm-hmm. And just looking how things are positioned.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started looking at the photographs, my path to, you know, realization with this was, you know, Tower 2, the top starts to tip.
Mm-hmm.
First, I thought that was an accident, but I've come to realize it was not. But then why? I think that was part of the routine.
Well, you seem to suggest in your Seattle talk that they were trying to minimize...
Shorten the building.
Shorten the building, you said, but also it would, if they did it other ways, then it would have done more damage.
Right. This is their first one, and they leaned it over. Well, if building one, if they did that first, they're gonna, if it tips a little bit west, it destroys WFC3. A little bit north, it destroys Verizon building. Tips south, it's gonna take chunks out of building two, which are gonna make it harder to control. Same with if they make it go east, it'll also interfere with building two. So if they start with building two, they don't want it to go west because it's interfering with building one, or north.
Now when you say if it were to go east, it would do this, and west it would do that, you're saying if it fell, if it started to fall at that point, right? Because
right,
it's high. It's not anywhere near those other buildings. It's up in the air.
But if the stuff starts to go one way, it's going to keep going that direction.
Right. I'm saying if it falls, then they can't control. Gravity is then in control of the fall.
Correct.
They have to be in control of it before gravity does anything to the remainder.
Right. Because when it starts spitting parts out, mm-hmm. you've got to be able to know where those parts are going to fly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and to be able to control how it's going to come down. And if they did one first and damaged two, a big chunk out of two, two might start tipping over or do something funny before they're able to control it. When they start to bring it down, it may twist over some direction because it's injured.
And once again, the purpose of controlling and minimizing damage was just to do that? Why would it matter if they destroyed a few more FC3 and other buildings?
Oh, they didn't want to destroy Manhattan.
Well,
they just want to destroy that building. That's what becomes apparent, is anything with the WTC prefix was getting destroyed, nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
We have WTC 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.
So they could rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
Urban renewal is what I call it.
So when that top tipped over building 4, it turned to dust before it hit the ground. but they had that as sort of a still zone in case they messed up. But if you notice, Building 4 went away. The main body of Building 4 just gone. Nothing there, down to the ground. Nothing. There's this north wing, the stub of it, that looks like it was sliced off surgically. It's a 9-story building, and you have this just this sliced off independent chunk, but the rest of it is just missing.
Mm.
Yeah, I don't mean absolutely zero. You have a few sticks, you know, sprinkled around. But there's no substance left of that building. And the few sticks sprinkled around are from the scattering of the last little bits of Building 2. But Building 4 disappeared.
So there was a method used that supersedes everything else we know about.
Yes.
But we don't know what that method is.
Correct.
So who has come up with the term directed energy?
Well, after I decided that there had to be some kind of gizmo that was doing this, then I started looking, and by golly, there's lots of information out there. And that's in the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
If it's in the public domain, it's been out there. You know, public domain is like 20 years behind the military.
At least.
And then let's think of another kind of directed energy we all know about. Microwave oven.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also specific of different materials.
Right. It doesn't heat the paper towel.
Right. And we don't see it happening. You don't see that wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
And what about your remote control for the TV set?
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that signal going. So we know that there are forms of energy that we do not see. Let's think of some other ones. Okay, microwave, that was actually invented or came to life in 1945.
Mm-hmm. Ancient.
Ancient. Think what was happening a couple of years before that. Hiroshima?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the day before Hiroshima happened, people thought there was such a gizmo out there?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you have this microwave technology that came to be. In the mid-50s, lasers. Now, don't you think they've kind of developed a more since then?
Well, I'm sure they have.
To the point we have keychain ornaments that come in different colors, red, green, blue, you know, mix and match. So it probably can soup them up quite a bit. I saw a wonderful article, I think it was in November or December, about some folks who got a bunch of old microwaves from microwave ovens from a junkyard and took the useful part of it, put it all together to make a more powerful thing. They made a directed energy weapon.
Hmm. And what was it capable of doing?
Improvised directed energy weapon. I do. From a junkyard with old microwave ovens.
Well, there was that Boy Scout who sent off for the Golden Book of Chemistry and got all kinds of radioactive materials from the hands of clocks and from batteries, and he built a nuclear reactor. So it can be done, but if civilians can do it, you're saying...
Oh, yeah, then the people who are trained to do it... The rocket scientists,
mm-hmm.
they surely can do it. So at that point, I convinced myself, well, the fact that I saw the evidence of it, that, you know, if you didn't know anything about a microwave, let's say it was you have to figure out how you're going to power the thing up. I was going to say the 1600s. You'd probably get called a witch, you know, for making fire. But take a microwave back way before its time. What are people going to think of that magic?
Well, they can't even imagine it. I mean, you know, it's like showing cavemen an airplane. He wouldn't know what to call it.
It's a pretty weird bird.
Mm-hmm.
It would blow its world apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we do have evidence of technology that that's consistent with. And isn't it interesting that since our web page has been, the article has been going up there, strange other developments have begun. Like, actually it was 2 days after I started posting the web page that it was announced that Bush had signed some document to supposedly renege on the treaty about not weaponizing space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's legal or not, but it seemed like an interesting timing. And we're hearing about all these new high-tech weapons now. We actually heard about them earlier, but it wasn't so loud about it. Now it's this concerted effort to educate the public as to what they do have so that they can use it out in broad daylight.
Well, they are pretending that they would use it for defense.
Uh-huh.
And what you're positing here obliquely is that this kind of technology was used right here for the first time.
Or it could have been used earlier, but we noticed it this time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know for sure what has been used in the past, but right in front of, right in your face.
Now, if I were to ask you how to invite John Doe and Jane Doe to seeing 9/11 as an inside job, how would you offer them this part of the theory?
Somebody who's never really entertained the idea before.
Mm-hmm.
The billiard ball example might be useful.
Right, as a starting point, but then would you keep this information from them?
Oh no. I think if somebody wants to know, they need to find out, because otherwise you're living in that fake world. And it's you know, time comes when silence is betrayal. They need to know how much trouble we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Because we need all the help we can get getting out of it.
We need all the collaboration we can create to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We need help from each other. We need our creativity.
Yeah.
We need to create a leap in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to happen by people being blind and asleep.
We're thinking it's somebody else's problem to fix. Not my job.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's how we got here.
Because we relegated the control and the fixing and the doing to others.
When did you realize about the 2004 selection? Well, the 2000 selection.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when Gore walked away, I knew something was wrong.
We gave up? Or?
Well, people were outraged, but there was no discussion about this. And I remember telling my mother, she said something like, oh, well, you know, so we have George Bush, so we'll just have to deal with it. And I said, it is going to be much, much worse than anyone can imagine. And I had no idea what I was talking about. That was just a feeling I had.
It was, but it doesn't matter if it's your candidate or not. The fact that the voters didn't get to choose is the problem.
Right.
And so let's say you didn't like that Elmer Fudd or whatever was running for president, and the votes got rigged in favor of the guy that you wanted. That's not good either. that it's no longer a free country. It's no longer a country you have control over. It's no longer the country you grew up in, or the idea you grew up with.
But that correlates with the fact that people are leaving the job of being free to someone else. People have really, they have handed over the keys to their own freedom by allowing themselves to be scripted and dictated to by advertising and trends and all of this.
I feel like they've been lured away from reality. Like, you know, this Survivor game on TV, whatever it is, and there's the Runaway Bride story, the Michael Jackson thing. Like, that's all that matters?
But there's
humanity out there.
Right. And there's a world out there with real things going on, not just stories.
Where they find one particular story and then they play it up to some heroic thing, ignoring the one right next to it that needs more attention. It becomes a fashion show or some other world. I don't do TV anymore. It's too bothersome.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't get any useful information out of it. Whatever is happening on there, you never know if there's any basis to it at all.
Well, you can only watch it to study it. It's sort of like it's an observation of an ongoing experiment.
But after a while, it's sort of pointless. It's once you figure that out, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, you seem very dedicated to doing this. This is your work now. And that's a great thing.
Because it matters. Nothing matters more.
And if you are a good teacher, then you can help people to think independently. That's what we need to do.
We all need to think for ourselves. We should never let someone else give us our opinion or issue us our opinion. And there's a lot of that going on. Maybe folks are too busy to think.
Mm-hmm.
We all are, I guess as animal instinct, sort of trained to follow some pattern. And it's easier to follow a pattern because you only make the decision once. You don't have to make it again and again. You just keep doing the same thing. But it's good to remember to revisit choices and ideas. And if you don't know which story to believe, believe yourself.
But you have to do the sanity check. You have to pull the physics book off the shelf and check the gravity coefficient.
Yes. Don't take things for granted. But that makes life more fun, doesn't it?
Well, it does if you're brave enough to discover where your sanity has lapsed and where reality is more than an appearance. Those are the scary things. If you go by appearances and all the appearances are uniform and they add up to the formula
that you've been programmed to.
Right, or the formulas of the matrix, then that's nice. Then that can be counted on. And we need a certain amount of regimen and routine in a world that is unpredictable, because life itself is unpredictable. I always look at little birds and how they hop around and they're constantly afraid and checking over their shoulders, and then they'll quickly eat something and hop a little more. And maybe I'm reading it wrong. Maybe I'm using my own references, but to me they look scared all the time. And I think that's a hell of a way to live.
I think of it differently. I've noticed the same thing about the birds hopping.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like they live faster than we do. They're just in a different time frame.
They live faster.
Yeah.
Their time goes faster.
Yeah, to us, we must look like we're really slowed down.
That's very interesting.
That was my perception when I've seen them, how they keep looking over their shoulder and back and forth.
Yeah, they dart.
But if you slow down, get a film of it and then run it in slow motion, they might look more like we look.
That's very interesting. So maybe different animals have different concepts of linear time. Their clocks run differently.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, Judy, thank you very much for this interview. It's a beautiful interview. I learned an awful lot.
Well, thank you.
That's our signal.
That was my email.
Okay.